responsible. And we have to open our eyes as a society and realize that it's not just seven aid workers that unfortunately died, but there were 17, 18,000 children that are shredded like paper. They just don't happen to be white children. And we have to open our eyes and care about them as much as we care about the seven aid workers that very unfortunately died.
I want to ask both of you a question, starting with Dr. Perlmutter. I mean, your credentials, you are an orthopedic surgeon, you are head of the World Surgical Foundation, past president of the International College of Surgeons. You're both American. Dr. Perlmutter, you're from a Jewish American family. Your twin is an Orthodox Jewish woman. Dr. Feroz Sidwa, Zoroastrian. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Perlmutter, you wrote two emails to the U.S. Embassy in Israel when you went, pleading with them not to attack European Gaza hospitals, saying we're deathly afraid of being bombed again, as we were this morning. What happened to you? And did the U.S. Embassy respond to you?
I sent them two letters. One when the bombs were shaking and they were shaking the fillings out of our teeth. It is as if lightning struck inches away from you. That's how much vibration the hospital ground sustained. Bombs did not actually enter into the walls of the hospital. They completely surrounded the hospital. The entire event occurred specifically to destroy the population outside the hospital. We were in fear of our lives. We were particularly in fear of our lives right after the bombing of the UN, the World Central Kitchen convoy, while we're in full knowledge that doctors were being kidnapped and targeted, almost 100 journalists were killed, destruction of multiple ambulances. We felt targeted from the beginning. So as we're approaching the end of our trip, and after we've heard that all other hospitals were being thoroughly destroyed and their surgeons being kidnapped, we were in fear of our own lives. More importantly, we're in fear of the tens of thousands of people that sought refuge in that hospital compound, hoping that a hospital would not be targeted. And so I wrote the American Embassy to both the Jerusalem and Tel Aviv offices. They sent me a return email acknowledging receipt of my first email. I've received no response from them. I've got acknowledgement from the first email that I sent. I sent a second email saying, this is the day we're leaving. Could you please inform the IDF that our convoy, just like the World Central Kitchen's convoy, is leaving at this time on this date. This is the vans, which is what the vans look like. This is the timing that we're going to leave. And I received no response from them as well.
You are talking to us from the hospital. You're in your scrubs in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And Dr. Feroz Sidwa, you're in Salt Lake City on your way back to Stockton, California, where you work. I'm looking at your piece again in Common Dreams, Dr. Sidwa. You write, no amount of medical care could ever compensate for the damage being inflicted here. Israel's dropped so much American ordnance on Gaza that it now exceeds the explosive force of the atomic bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. Can you talk about what you would say if you got to speak to President Biden? We interviewed Dr. Thayer Ahmed, who had just returned from Gaza. We believe he's the first doctor on the ground in Gaza to actually directly address the president. He handed him a letter from an 8-year-old Palestinian orphan and then walked out of the White House. He said, what can be said about what is happening here right now is the day after the attack on the World Central Kitchen. What is your message, and not only to the president, but around the world, Dr. Sidwa?
I don't think I would say much to Joe Biden. I think he knows exactly what's going on, and I don't think it's important to him. I don't think he cares if Palestinians are murdered like roaches and ants. But to the rest of Americans who have normal human values, they do care. And, one of the other things that Mark and I wrote in that piece is that the blood on the trauma bay floor and the operating room floor was dripping from our hands. And that's, I think that's accurate. We, again, we provide the crucial military, economic, and diplomatic support. Your viewers are no surprise to that. And that makes us responsible. If our support stops, the attacks stop. If our support stops, the occupation stops. It's instant. It's been proven 100 times. It's not hard to, not hard to see. And so that's what I would say to people is if you want to stop participating unwittingly in these, in some of the worst crimes that I've ever seen in my life, then you need to organize and you need to raise the cost to people like Joe Biden, because that is the only thing they care about. The U.S. is attempting to manage the Middle East with the system that I put in place since the Arab Spring, and the Palestinians are just kind of an annoyance to that system. They don't want to, the U.S. doesn't want Saudi Arabia to get, to have its ruling family shaken, the Jordanian ruling family shaken. But we have to raise the domestic cost for these policies, which, like Mark said, are really, is truly genuinely genocidal in nature, that they're it's dramatic. So I would say to people that, you know what's going on, so stop thinking about it all that much and just start acting. Go to your houses of worship, go to your community centers, go wherever it is that you go and talk to people and say, look, let's go talk to our congressman in person. Let's demand a meeting. If you're a veteran, put your uniform on and go. I've had several veterans reach out to me. Put your uniform on and go talk to your congressperson. Film it. Put it online. Do anything you can to embarrass these people and to make it obvious to the world that they are not acting with normal human decency in mind. They're acting with purely cold, almost mafia-like political calculations. And the only way that we are going to stop this is by raising the cost to them of doing so. That's what I would say to people, I think.
Well, Dr. Sidva, of course, the justification, the continued justification for Israel's assault is the fact that they're targeting Hamas militants. You treated, we've just heard from both of you about the number of children you treated, mostly, as you said, elementary school children or below the age of elementary school. You dealt with numerous mass casualty events while you were at the European hospital in Khan Yunus. How many military age males did you treat?
I can count them on one hand. I think it was probably 4 or 5. And not one of them, they obviously, they're, like Mark said, the people who are actually in Hamas or other or the other Palestinian militant organizations is an extremely small number, even of military age men in the Gaza Strip. But we treated a handful, five at the very most that I can remember, military age men while we were there for any injury at all. The overwhelming consensus in the hospital was that if actual militants were to come in, they would actually come in with their, I don't know the technical terms, but with their unit and with their commander, and they would be spirited away from the hospital as soon as they were well enough to be taken out of the hospital. That never happened once to anybody. So I seriously doubt that I encountered a single combatant while I was there. It was a 100% civilian. I think the people I cared for were 100% civilians, even including the military age men that I took care of.
Finally, Dr. Perlmutter, if you could say, you know, what you think the medical needs there are now. I mean, there are no fully functional hospitals left at all. You've said that you could operate 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for years and not make a dent because the needs are so great. So what can be done for people in Gaza suffering in this way as this war goes on?
Right. 2 points. First, I've seen more orthopedic injuries in my 2 weeks there than I have seen in my entire 30-plus years of practicing and the additional 10 years of training before that. If I operated 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, it would take me 20 years for me to make a notable dent, a minuscule dent in the amount of orthopedic alone pathology that's there. The extent of damage, of carnage, is that widespread. In order to make a difference, it's not by supplying supplies, it's by eliminating the genocide. It's eliminating, it's imposing controls on Israel. It's by reaching out, as Dr. Sidwa said, to our senators. That letter that you read, I sent a copy of that to every single sitting U.S. senator. I called Chuck Schumer's office from Gaza while I'm being bombed and spoke to his secretary and said the noises in the background are American bombs being dropped by American warplanes, gifted essentially to Israel. And I'm in fear that they're going to kill me. I'm in bigger fear that it's going to keep me up all night with another dozen shredded children and women. As Dr. Sidwa said, I don't think I saw one person who would qualify as a military combatant. The victims were civilian, virtually 100%. I would echo his plea to please contact your state senator and House of Representatives and the federal ones as well. Share with them the knowledge that the sterilized history that they've been receiving and the sterilized facts that they have been receiving are in fact inaccurate, that there's true bloodshed that's going on at our hands that we're paying for. And they need to wake up and realize that it's not the payoff from the Israeli Political Action Committee that really matters to keep their jobs moving forward and their re-election occurring. What really should matter is the ethical basis of what they're charged to do, and that's to maintain the viability of the United States' image and our leader as a democratic nation supporting perfect ideals and not advancing their own personal agenda by supporting a state that's recklessly killing innocent women and children, something that every American should stand against.
Dr. Mark Perlmutter, I want to thank you so much for joining us, orthopedics hand surgery specialist, president of the World Surgical Foundation, immediate past president of the International College of Surgeons, speaking to us from now, his hospital in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, in his scrubs. And Dr. Feroz Sidwa, trauma surgeon, speaking to us from Salt Lake City, heading back to Stockton, California, where he works. They just returned Monday from volunteering at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza. We'll link to the piece they co-authored in Common Dreams, We Have Never Seen Cruelty Like Israel's Genocide in Gaza. When we come back, we go to Arizona for an update on how Republicans blocked efforts to repeal a 160-year-old near-total abortion ban. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the swing state of Arizona, where Republican lawmakers have blocked efforts by Democrats to repeal an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions in the state. The move came a day after Arizona's Supreme Court revived the 160-year-old law approved before Arizona was a state, and before women could even vote. Vice President Kamala Harris is on a Fight for Reproductive Freedoms tour that will visit Tucson on Friday. The court issued its decision a day after Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump said abortion should be decided by the states. Trump said Wednesday the Arizona ruling went too far.
We're joined now by Chris Love, spokesperson for Arizona for Abortion Access, a coalition working to put a state constitutional amendment on abortion on Arizona's November ballot. In Tucson, Alejandra Pablos is with us, reproductive justice community organizer who was targeted by ICE for her activism and faced deportation proceedings for over a decade. And in Phoenix, Arizona, we're joined by Dr. Deshaun Taylor, OBGYN physician, abortion provider, CEO of the nonprofit Desert Star Institute for Family Planning in Phoenix, Arizona, the only Black woman-operated abortion clinic in Arizona. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Dr. Deshaun Taylor, let's begin with you. You're a physician. The Arizona State Supreme Court, five of its seven justices chosen by the previous Republican governor, Ducey, have just reverted Arizona to this 160-year-old law that was put in place before women could vote, before Arizona was a state. And it says not rape, not incest. Only the life of a mother or the death of a mother, the imminent death of a mother, could lead to a woman, could lead to the possibility of doing an abortion. What does this mean for you practically today? It hasn't been put into effect for, 14 days, and we'll see what happens. But yesterday we saw what happened in the state legislature. They simply adjourned before doing anything.
Basically, what this means is that people will not get their needed abortions in the state of Arizona. These laws carry prison time. And I, as an abortion provider, appreciate the words of our governor and our attorney general. But at the end of the day, someone has to test whether what they say they're going to do is true. So these lawmakers understand that the threatening us with prison time is very compelling and has a chilling effect. And so essentially abortions likely will not happen in Arizona because of those criminal penalties assigned to them, as we see going on across the country.
And Dr. Taylor, just to clarify, according to a survey for the Society of Family Planning, about 1,100 abortions take place every month in Arizona. Where will women go now to seek abortions?
What I want your viewers to understand is it was challenging for people to get abortions even prior to Roe v. Wade being overturned due to the web of restrictions, nearly 40 restrictions on the books in this state. And so people were already increasingly self-managing their abortions. People are already leaving our state who had the resources to do so. But the overwhelming majority of people who don't get their abortions have babies or become ill and potentially lose their lives. So what we see is these escalating things happening to our population, which are forcing people to take matters into their own hands, number one, or stay pregnant, because most people don't have the resources to leave the state for an abortion.
I wanted to bring Chris Love into this conversation. Even before the Supreme Court ruled, the state Supreme Court ruled, this coalition had formed and has been gathering signatures for a November referendum, a constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right to abortion, Arizona for Abortion Access, it's called. You have, what, 500,000 signatures? Isn't that ready to go? What are you waiting for at this point? Are you concerned that it still wouldn't get on the ballot?
So at this point, we're 3 months out from having to turn in all of our qualifying signatures. We have to turn in 384,000 valid signatures by July 3rd of this year. In Arizona, we collect far more signatures than we need because those signatures are easily challenged in our courts and sometimes thrown out. So we're aiming to collect more than double the amount to ensure that we are on the ballot in November. And, you know, I am very confident that we will be. We've seen a groundswell of, you know, Arizona voters who really understand that decisions about abortion should remain between a pregnant person and their medical provider and their family members if they so choose. But politicians, and especially now activist judges, have no role in that decision.
I wanted to ask Alejandra Pablos, an Arizona reproductive justice activist, does this ruling affect communities of color differently? If you can explain that. You yourself have been targeted for deportation as reproductive justice activists for a decade. But what does this particularly mean?
Thank you, Amy. Really good to be back amongst comrades that are doing great work in Arizona. Like you said, as an organizer, as somebody who's been sharing their story of being incarcerated, of being facing deportation, of having an abortion as a form of resistance, because we know where we are living and where we have been living way before Roe, the fact is that it was never enough for me and the organizing that we do as a person who's been criminalized, surveilled, right, for how I look, how I speak. We live in a country where the president doesn't, he can't even say the word abortion, right? So really, the people that are still making decisions for us don't look like us, right? So, but people like myself have been organizing for reproductive rights, fighting stigma, right? We know what we want, and we want people to have the care that they need. We know that there are so many reasons why people do not want to parent, and reproductive justice is about, you know, supporting folks who want to parent, who do not want to bear children, right? And when we do want to parent, to do it in safe and sustainable communities. Like you said, I've been facing deportation, and sometimes I feel like that's already a choice that's been taken from me, right? Because who wants to parent under this stress? And the truth is that most people of color, migrant people, young people, trans, non-binary people who have abortion and need this reproductive health care have been, right, taken this choice away from them. We don't have the resources. We've been crying out to defund the police because it is a cry to fund our communities. We are creating constantly, lawmakers are creating desperate communities, right? We're going to be forcing people to have abortions and then blaming it on us, right? And fighting stigma right now for myself is where I want to focus my energy. I think as I created a project called Abortion Showers Project, where it is led by trans people, non-binary people, people from the Americas, right? That we understand it's our responsibility to fight and to talk about abortion care in a loving way, because we've been taking care of each other for so long. So I think that's kind of some of the work I'm focusing on right now, because again, talking about this issue in Spanish, right? The United States is made up of non-white, non-English speaking people, right? So I think that's one way that I'm really fighting to really like love on our people in this moment where there's so much violence in Arizona. So our work right now really is to keep fighting stigma, right? To keep on sharing and fighting for education that's real, that's centered in real stories. And the plain and simple matter is that there's so much racism. It is a racial justice issue, right? Who are we trying to force to have abortions? Deshaun talked about prison. We already have the highest incarceration rates in the world in Arizona. And are we going to be filling it up with pregnant people? Or is that the only place we're going to force people to have abortions? Right? It's just really, really scary moment right now.
Well, Dr. Taylor, just to put this antediluvian ruling in context, in France, just earlier this year on International Women's Day, they actually enshrined abortion rights in their constitution. So if you could say, what steps now are doctors going to take, abortion providers like yourself, to reassure women who come to you? And also, in the future, how are you organizing? What are you planning to do?
Right now, we are going to continue to provide abortions until we are made to stop. So that's the first thing. The second piece of this is Desert Star is an independent abortion clinic. And independent abortion clinics are closing at alarming rates across the country. And we know that when an independent abortion clinic closes, then it's gone. We don't have resources and infrastructure to sustain and withstand these political attacks on abortion. Thankfully, Desert Star in Arizona is now a nonprofit. And so I am confident our board of directors are committed to keeping the doors open so that once the pendulum swings back and we would be able to provide abortion again, that we will be able to do so because we still have all of the licenses, all of the protocols, and all of the things required to provide. But in the interim, we are also a provider of gender-affirming hormone therapy for transgender adults. We provide well exams, pap smears, we provide birth control, and all of those other things. So we have the opportunity to continue to provide services and then pivot into a community resource to assist abortion seekers in some way to get the needed abortions. And that is something that we're in progress with. And each individual provider will need to seek legal counsel and determine what level of risk that they are willing to assume to continue to help people in Arizona who need abortions.
Very quickly, Dr. Taylor, the Attorney General of Arizona, Chris Mays, said she will not enforce this 160-year-old law, saying, quote, no woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law. No woman or doctor will be prosecuted, she said, and also is appealing to attorney generals of the surrounding states to get women over the border or people who are pregnant over the border to places where they will be safe, like in Colorado. Do you think you're going to have to, if this remains, close down your clinic? And are you willing to go to jail? Like, what does it mean to say only in the case of the life of the mother? In Texas, a woman is suing because she kept going to the doctor, wanted to have a baby desperately. The fetus died in her, and they said she wasn't septic enough and now probably can never have a child again because of what she experienced.
So I said this before, and I will say it again. I did not go to medical school to go to prison. Therefore, I am not interested in being martyred in this scenario. I should not be in this scenario. We should not have these lawmakers making these types of laws that put my freedom in jeopardy just for providing the services and using the skills that I have honed over 23 years of my adult life. So I am, with my sleeves rolled up, deeply involved in community organizing and strategizing with people like Alejandra, where we will make sure that people get what they need. Otherwise, I have to go on the record, because what we do know is the people who are criminalized look like me. So if anybody's going to challenge this law, it is not a physician that looks like me. And I think that because I am 2% of the physician workforce in the United States as a Black woman, Black people need me to stay free, and the other people that I care for who are people of color and people who speak different languages need the caring care that I provide and what I am committed to provide in the community that I serve, which is medically underserved, ethnically diverse, socioeconomically depressed, and they deserve just dignified and qualified care by a provider who looks like them, speaks their language, and cares for them in a way that makes them feel seen, heard, and well cared for. I will say that
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second because I want to give Chris Love the last word, and we just have 30 seconds. You want to get to 1 million signatures. How are you going to do that at this point? What has the response been since yesterday?
Well, we've obviously had a groundswell of support from Arizona voters who are mad as hell that this has happened. Obviously, our signature numbers are up. We'll be collecting signatures through the weekend. Our fundraising efforts are up. I think Arizona voters truly believe that our judges have gone too far and they need to have the say of that.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Chris Love of Arizona for Abortion Access, Alejandra Pablos, Arizona reproductive justice activist, and Dr. Deshaun Taylor, OBGYN physician. She is head of Desert Star Institute for Family Planning in Phoenix. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 19th to 23rd. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring New York experimental hardcore trio Show Me the Body as guest curator, incisive Chicago rapper Mick Jenkins, Los Angeles indie rockers Cherry Glazer, genre-bending rap artist Carrie Foe, Montreal-based hip-hop trio Planet Giza, 70s Zamrock revivalist Witch, renowned soundscape composer Laurel Halo, British electronic producer Forest Swords, eminent post-punk three-piece Wombo, Philadelphia hardcore punk group Soul Glow, and many more. Plus, there's over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your...
Hey, folks.